As one of America's largest financial services companies, Nationwide supports financial professionals with client-friendly resources and innovative solutions to help create greater retirement security for their clients. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It's packed with benefits to help unlock more value from your business purchases. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
This is the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene, along with Jonathan Farrow and Lisa Abramowitz. Join us each day for insight from the best in economics, geopolitics, finance, and investment. Subscribe to Bloomberg Surveillance On Demand on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere you get your podcasts. And always on Bloomberg.com, the Bloomberg Terminal, and the Bloomberg Business App. Right now, we're going to begin here, Manus Krani, Lisa Abramowitz, and Tom Keene, with our definitive call of the day on global fixed income. Wei Li is Global Chief Investment Strategist at BlackRock, prodigious in mathematics, and joins us here on our fears of price down and yield up. Wei Li, thank you so much for finding the time. Where is the bid on bonds? To me, the bid is walked away. Is that true? Is there just a dearth of bid across all of fixed income?
There are lots of moving parts right now. Good morning, everyone. In terms of our view on long bonds, long duration, we have been underweight U.S. long duration for 3 years now, since late 2020, when 10-year yields was below 1%. And last week, we closed the underweight to get to neutral. There are a couple of moving parts in terms of why rates have repriced so very meaningfully. The first piece is policy path repricing. And the second piece is term premium repricing, and within that, inflation premium is part of term premium. So where we are now with 10-year yields testing 5%, in our assessment, policy path is not that different from where we think it should be. But term premium, depending on which measure you use, we're looking at somewhere between 20 basis point, 40 basis point, different methodology, actually could push even higher over the strategic horizon. So we're talking about term premium over the strategic horizon at 100 basis point, not out of this world because of fiscal imbalance, because of issuance dynamics, because of higher rate environment, rate volatility, as well as because of higher inflationary environment. So when you bring all of that together, strategically we're still underweight, but tactically we're now neutral because risks have now become more balanced. And when we think about kind of the read across of rate repricing to risk assets, actually policy path repricing can be negative for equities because it impacts the discount rates directly. But term premium repricing doesn't have to be negative for equities because it's more an assessment of the relative appeal of duration in portfolios.
Do you think, Wei, I know that you've been leaning into the whole AI discussion and the whole AI thesis, and that's been driving some of your equity bets. Do you think that that area is completely immune to term premia and these discussions of yields, given the cash cows that they've become?
Well, what has been very interesting with regards to this mega tech and AI theme is that on the one hand, they benefit from the growth upgrades, earnings upgrades that we're seeing coming through. So, for example, next year, 10% EPS forecast for S&P 500. Half of that is driven by mega tech names, right? 5% is coming from the tech names. So they're definitely benefiting from earnings upgrades, which we pay a lot of attention to. But at the same time, they are more long duration compared with the broader equity market. So when rate reprices, it pressures down on long duration a little bit more, everything else being equal. But when you bring the two factors together, actually the growth prospect and the AI theme gathering momentum and the earnings upgrades actually trump the duration sensitivity, as we have seen so far earlier in the year, but also in recent periods of rate repricing. Actually, the AI theme, the Nasdaq, have been holding up better than you would have expected given the rate volatility.
Wei Li, good morning. Just to carry on from that, this week they're going to see $16 trillion worth of equity reports, and the magnificent part of the Magnificent Seven of tech are going to be in there. What Tom Lisa and myself, what we're talking about was the balance sheets, the cash on the balance sheets, the cash on Apple's balance sheet, the cash on the other big tech. Is that another defensive hallmark and a reason to endure and stay long big tech?
That is why we are still overweight the big tech and AI theme, because when we think about kind of quality characteristics, as growth slows down, reacts to the tightening environment that we're all experiencing, actually having cash on your balance sheet and not being as geared up in this environment is a definite plus. And more broadly, we're talking about kind of the impression of the earnings season, that the feeling is that it's holding up better, but actually not forget the broader backdrop, which is the earnings. Mm-hmm. Actually, the three quarters have been stagnating. And we're just talking about incremental rebound from the stagnating backdrop. So that's the big picture here.
Whaley Lawrence from New York emails in and says, ask Whaley, if an institutional firm marks to market and everything else is on the balance sheet and the rationalization is I can own it forever and I'll get paid back eventually, baloney. How do you do the math on the midpoint of where the stuff you hold on the balance sheet gets a valuation? If I've got 8 years of maturity, how close is it to where you get a tipping point where you've got to confront what's on the balance sheet?
Well, first, say hello to Lawrence. And second, yes, indeed, we have to see more repricing of risk assets reflecting the higher rate environment. We look at duration, we're kind of almost there, which is why tactically we turned neutral. But if you look at equities, it has yet to reflect the higher rate environment by our very simple kind of arithmetic, kind of very simple back of the envelope analysis, you know, like further 5% to 10% adjustment is not, you know, unthinkable. And then you think about private markets, there is also further repricing to go, which is why greater dispersion, greater selectivity is really warranted as we think about kind of deploying your risk budget in this environment, because there is a different rate sensitivity across risk spectrum, which is why we're very selective when it comes to equities. Right. We're focusing on sector style growing earnings, but also very selective in terms of the private market. We like private credit, we like infrastructure debt, all these parts of private markets that benefit from secular tailwinds.
I don't hear full faith in credit there. Whaley, thank you so much of BlackRock. Tom Sitsouris is with Strategus. It's a Baird company. He's had a fixed income, but he's got to bounce off the great Jason Trenert as well. And you floored me with an analysis that 70% of America are voters that are small business and they're in the churn and they only make up 5% of the GDP. Has the Fed left them behind in this yield environment?
Well, I would very much say so. The Fed, by overly relying on the Fed funds rate to tighten, has put so much of that pain on Main Street USA. It's almost as if we've decided there's too big to fail. Earlier this year, we decided their medium is too big to fail. Medium-sized businesses, Silicon Valley Bank, Signature Bank, depositors there. So if that means that if there's large companies are too big to fail, medium-sized companies are too big to fail, the only place you can actually tighten in the U.S. economy these days is small businesses and households. And the Fed has done exactly that by overly relying on the Fed funds rate. With that said, balance sheet reduction is catching up with the bond market now, and we're seeing treasury yields rise in the belly of the curve.
Okay, and we'll get there in one sec, which is the technical underpinnings of why we're seeing a sell-off. But to stick on the point that Tom was talking about, if you have such a swath of the voter base that is feeling this kind of pain, and if you have small businesses that account for a significant proportion of the jobs losing momentum, when does that start to trickle into a higher unemployment rate? When does it start to reinforce and then actually bring rates down because of slower growth?
Well, we were already at that point in March of this year. We were 48 hours from a recession, which would have been very deep. And then we had financial stabilization via liquidity injections. So when does it begin to bite again? Probably sometime between Christmas and, we'll say, Valentine's Day, when the consumer gets those late 2023 credit card bills in January, and you start to see a pullback. I don't see any sort of slowdown in consumption. We didn't see it in the data last week. So that suggests to us the labor market's going to continue to remain strong, at least until the end of the year. But at some point in time, those higher interest rates are going to bite all corners of the economy, not just small businesses and households.
Are yields rising right now because of the perception of strength that is given by some of the bigger businesses that are much stronger?
I don't think so. I think yields are rising because we're finally seeing supply come in and really scare those bond vigilantes. The bond vigilantes are back, and they're pushing the term premium up on all treasuries, not just the front end of the curve now.
Well, they've been unleashed not just in the U.S. Treasury market, but also in U.K. gilts and on bonds. What goes through my mind is that when you trigger through 5% and you see the curve moving so aggressively, do you think that we hit some kind of a point of where risk parity trades begin to get smacked, or where VAR limits at various trading houses get triggered? Do you think that we're going to go into that next evolution of where we see a real liquidation moment?
That's a tough question, because I think we've seen, now this is really the third substantial rise in 10-year Treasury yields we've seen over the last 3 years. Each time you've probably seen those VAR strategies take a turn of leverage off along the way. Mm-hmm. So the sensitivity today to a 5% is probably less than it was to a 3% 2 years ago, because they've taken, from what we can see, there's been some leverage that's come off. With that said, there's always another break point. I don't know if it's 502 or 517, or we might have already hit it at 490. But there's a break point here where you're going to see another round of leverage come off. And that's part of the reason why it's probably a multi-step process, but that's probably one of the reasons why we're seeing the S&P off again as well, and credit spreads inching higher, because I think we're getting close to that point again.
So who steps in here? This is the debate that the three of us have had for the past 2 hours, which is duration heroes aren't to be seen yet. Yep. You're trading above 5%. Insurance companies have a different accounting system. They don't need to come in and hedge themselves. Who steps into this bond market to cap yields?
Well, there's a good and a bad to this. The good is there's an enormous...
Give me the good.
The good is there's an enormous amount of plain vanilla core fixed income strategies that will just love to keep buying and buying and buying treasuries. The bad news is those are price-sensitive investors. They're not like the leveraged investors of the past. So they're going to basically come in after there's a concession. So treasury supply comes in, yields tick a little higher, they come in and buy on the cheap. They're not going to be price insensitive who will buy on any dip.
You are a grizzled veteran of this. I'm going to give you two ideas. One that we talked to Wei Li about at BlackRock, which is the bid walks away. All of a sudden on price, folks, not yield, price of bonds, the bid walks away, and the great Chris Whalen calls this the Whalen silence. You're out there, you're on your phone. This is the old days, man. You'd buy tickets here, sell tickets here. You're on your phone, and you're going, I got a gazillion dollars of the Trenor, you know what, and there's just silence. Nobody wants that piece of paper. Are we close to that?
Well, some would say we've actually hit that. People, there was a lot of fear about 30-year auction. There's a lot of fear about auctions on the front end of the curve over the last few weeks, saying there were even headlines.
What about deaths? Norway calls up and they go, I got to sell a zillion years of that cranny of 2042. Is there somebody there to buy this garbage?
There is, but you're going to have to put in a price concession. That is, yields are going to have to push higher than what the market is trading at. And the Treasury is now no longer immune to this.
I said price concession, and the Bramo cam shook. I mean, that's the reality.
Just real quick here, Tom, to sum it all together, are you getting compensated for the uncertainty right now? Are you buying duration?
Yes, we would be. I think you're being fairly compensated. Our own measure of the term premium on the 10-year Treasury, it's above 100 basis points. That's a very important level, not just symbolically, but what it's telling you is that you're getting a normalized cushion for that uncertainty. This is where you normally would be. So we feel you're being compensated. Doesn't mean we can't see yields tick higher here, but you're being compensated for the risk going forward, I believe, at this point
in time. Jason from a cigar bar in the East Side emails in and says, talk about me. Okay, let's talk about Jason Trenor. How does this fold in? How does your fixed income analysis fold into Jason Trenor's call on this on the equity markets?
Well, it makes us that much more bearish on the economy, because we continue to see another source of stress for the consumer, and now businesses picking up here. So what we're doing is we've delayed recession, and we've said we're going to avoid recession at all costs in 2023. But that itself, there's cost to that. And the cost is going to be that the breaking point is going to be when yields are higher, which means there's more risk of financial credit events.
And are you predicting that?
Nothing that we can see right now, but by the nature of those types of events, they're places you can't see them.
So, can't see that.
So at a 5% 10-year Treasury, it's much more likely than it was when we were at 350.
Right.
So where it is lurking, that leveraged investor who is caught off guard, we don't know. We don't see that happening at this moment, but it's on on our horizon.
Bottle it. Tom Cesoris there of Strategus there in fixed income, the effect across all of the American economy.
Inflation, market volatility, economic insecurity. Who isn't looking for greater retirement security these days? As one of America's largest financial services companies, Nationwide helps millions of people invest in their financial futures. With client-friendly resources and innovative solutions, Nationwide supports financial professionals so they can help clients feel more confident in their retirement years. Nationwide is on your side. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It's packed with benefits to help unlock more value from your business purchases. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Kathleen Bastiancic joins us now, Chief Economist, Nationwide Mutual Insurance. Kathy, once again, you have failed, and everybody else, with a bang-up third-quarter GDP modeled out at 5%. You're going to tell me we can't sustain that. All my radar's up. Why can't we sustain above-average real GDP?
Good morning, Tom. Well, it is unsustainable. And the main reason is that we just don't have enough workers, really. If you break down GDP growth, right, you look at the number of workers and how productive. Unless we're getting a real boom in productivity growth, really hard to sustain 5% growth. And what it also does in the meantime, as you know, is overheats the economy and makes it more difficult for the Fed Reserve to lower inflation. And that's their primary goal. So I think one way or the other, Fed will lower inflation and continue to lower it. But that may, you know, that means that 5% is not very sustainable.
Where are you on the, good morning. Good to see you. Where are you on the outlook for wages? Is the heat and I suppose the fury of wage negotiation, is that in the rearview mirror as you look into 2024?
Yeah, good question, Manus. So we're keeping an eye on wage growth, but what we have seen, despite the numerous strikes that have popped up and concerns there, we've actually seen wage growth decelerate. It's come down from 6-7%. It's still running too high for the Fed's comfort, right? It's running around 4% or so, a little bit above that. They'd really like to see that between 3 and 3.5 to be consistent with 2% inflation. But, you know, going back to labor market is the key right now in terms of wage growth, but also how long this, you know, strong growth continues. It's not ultimately sustainable, but do we see some meaningful slowdown in the fourth quarter? That's really what's important.
Tom chastened me a little bit earlier on. There's a great phrase that I use, if it's grand. It depends how I say the word grand. Grand can mean many different things. Mm-hmm. I said the U.S. consumer is grand, and Tom rightly chastened me. He said, did you look at the delinquencies on subprime in the auto industry? Did you look at perhaps the underbelly of what is going on? We're going to get retail sales, you know, they remain grand in inverted commas. But suddenly we're dealing with a shift in rates to above 5%. Would you describe the consumer as grand, or how challenged does the consumer become in a world of where rates actually tightening?
Yeah, I think the way I would say it is the consumer looks to be grand, but there are a lot of headwinds hitting the consumer. Now, the tailwind has been the labor market, very strong, right? As long as the labor market is churning out the amount of jobs, you know, 200,000, 300,000, right, the consumer's going to keep spending. But you have the still elevated inflation. You have consumer loan payments, you know, kicking in. And as you said, certain demographics are really challenged right now. And delinquency is picking up a little bit. So it's not a completely rosy picture here. But I would just say you got to follow the labor market. That is the key.
So if I'm the Fed, I'm going to follow the labor market. I'm data dependent. But I would suggest November 1-ish is upon us. And, you know, we're going to sort of have a post-Halloween party. I guess it's a non-meeting. December, for Kathy Bastiancic, how key is the December meeting?
Oh, it's important. You know, I think each meeting is important in the sense, not what they do, but it's what Chairman Powell guides us, right? What do we hear in the press conference? But December, we'll get the revised forecast, right? We'll get the macro forecast and the dot plot estimate. Even though those aren't, you know, golden rule, right? It doesn't mean that's exactly what the Fed's going to do, right? But it's guidance. It'll be interesting to see. Our view is growth slows by more than half, right, in the fourth quarter. We see it running a bit above 2%. But I have to say that handoff, you know, Manus talked about retail sales. The handoff consumer spending to the fourth quarter was a bit firmer than we thought. We need to see growth for the Fed to feel comfortable below 2%. I mean, Chairman Powell told us he thinks real potential growth is 2%, right? So he wants it on a sustained basis.
I mean, Kathy, you're with Nationwide. Do you have tickets to Michigan right around Thanksgiving? I mean, it's at Michigan. I get that. But you're Kathy Buss Johnson. Can you get us into 100,000 people at Ann Arbor?
Only if you're voting for Ohio State. It can only do that.
Very good. We're from Columbus and Nationwide. Kathleen Buss Johnson. Let's get right to it. Your definitive brief here on this transaction, $60 billion of a total enterprise value. Amrita Sen, expert at the micro foundations of the price of oil, and also expert out of the geography of oil. Amrita, I was up to speed on this in a FACO way, and I'm getting up to speed quickly. Guyana, 2015. Exxon finds more oil than God in the Gulf of Mexico off of South America. This is Hess, and this is a Guyana acquisition by Mr. Wirth in Chevron. Explain to our audience the magnitude of the Guyana oil fields.
I think it's a fantastic acquisition, if you ask me, given the fact that Guyana is actually going to be the most prolific non-OPEC supply growth in the coming years. Exxon, like you said, already has footprint, and as does Hess. So Chevron now, through Hess, gets exposure to that. You know, Guyana's production has been growing by 200,000 to 300,000 barrels per day. It's got several new FPSOs planned in the coming years. We're talking about production breaching 1 million barrels per day and continuing to grow. So it is, like I said, the most promising non-OPEC supply prospect. You know, we've had Brazil take that position for the last few years, and that's now flipped to Guyana. So again, in that sense, a fantastic acquisition.
What is the distinction of Guyana, and then I believe it is too, I got to get my map out, Manus, I'm going down in flames here. What is the distinction between Guyana and Venezuela on the southern side of the Caribbean?
I mean, of course, there's political stability for one, and the quality of oil. The quality of oil Guyana produces is actually very good quality. It's sweeter. It's really liked by even European refiners who sometimes struggle to process a lot of the heavier sour barrels. Venezuelan oil is very, very heavy oil. It's liked by a lot of refiners, like in the U.S. Gulf Coast, that have the capacity to process that. It requires what you call cokers, but not every refiner has that. So Guyana's oil is actually easier to process in that sense. Of course, in today's day and age, though, because we have a lot of refineries around the world who need that heavy oil, the lifting of sanctions on Venezuela would actually be welcome, of course, if that is to be sustained and if there are free and fair elections. And there are lots of question marks around that.
Amrita, surveillance correction here. Guyana to the east of Venezuela by 600 miles between Caracas and Georgetown.
Thank you.
Nailing that. One of our interns just saved me on that.
Not going to fly with you. Are we?
Well, Amrita, there is a question. Why are we seeing so many of these acquisitions right now in the oil patch?
I mean, you know, this is something our team, our U.S. upstream team, has been pointing out since July. We actually identified 80 companies that we thought was up for grabs. I'll happily share that list with you guys. And I think of that, about 17, 18 have already happened. If you think about the shale patch of the last decade, it was fueled by zero interest rates, and it was fueled by focusing on not shareholder growth or cash flow, but it was all about production growth. So it didn't matter whether you made money or not, just come pump and produce as much oil. That's changed now. Over the last few years, we've seen actually shareholders say, no, you actually need to return money to us, which means a lot of the acreage and a lot of the companies that had poor acreage just produced anyways, they have to get basically integrated with bigger companies who have economies of scale, because that's the only way you can generate cash. So that's the main reason why we are seeing this. And then, of course, as interest rates go up, servicing a lot of these debts that they have, a lot of the companies have very, very high debts, just isn't feasible. And that's why you will continue to see consolidation. We think this is just the start and we're going to see a lot more going forward.
So Amrita, how much is this also a result of maybe antitrust agents in the U.S. looking more favorably on some of these tie-ups because there is this goal to offset some of the supply fluctuations in the Middle East?
I mean, look, I think that's at the margin, right? If you think about the kind of deals being done or look at the deals being done, it started with Occidental back, you know, not this year, but previously. It's always about getting the acreage, which is right next to yours, so that you can have economies of scale. And I think that's the underlying reason for that. And of course, even with these acquisitions, it doesn't necessarily mean you're going to get more production. More often than not, 1+1 rigs is giving us 1.2 rigs, not two, because a lot of the rigs, like I was saying earlier, is actually poor quality. So the bigger company is simply saying, we're not going to produce from here, and therefore overall production actually goes down. Exxon and Pioneer are the exception there. Every other M&A we've seen actually is leading to lowering overall guidance of the two companies rather than raising it.
Amrita, good to see you this morning. Does any of this deal making that you see go through reflect anticipation of a change or a material change in U.S. energy policy? We're coming, I don't know whether we're coming to the end of a Biden administration, but we're going into an election year. Policy may change. America, oil independence is key. Any of the political aspects play into the potential for deal making?
I don't think so, in the sense, again, these are kind of company-specific deals that we're talking about. I think the bigger challenge, of course, we have is, I mean, look, the U.S. is producing above 13 million barrels per day, which is a record high anyways, and U.S. production continues to grow. Of course, the challenge, I was saying, is that you do have sanctions being lifted on Venezuela, even though elections haven't been held and there are still bans on the opposition candidate. That raises more questions around the shale oil guys and saying, why are we not being given the opportunity to produce even more, rather than you going and doing deals elsewhere.
Amrita, I'll see you in a month's time in Vienna. There is an official video of Amrita and I dancing in OPEC during COVID, going toe-to-toe.
See the life.
Dancing.
We are so sheltered.
living the life in Vienna. Quick question on Vienna as we go to Vienna. The theory is this, that the U.S. goes to refill the SPR over the next couple of months, gives Saudi and Russia some kind of caveat to release some of the unilateral cuts. Is that pie in the sky, hopeful thinking? What is your anticipation as we go to Vienna?
I do not buy that. I think Saudi Arabia has been very clear in saying they're keeping the cuts in place because of the macroeconomic concerns. Look, the U.S. has said this before as well, that, oh, we're going to buy it when it was kind of, you know, less than $80. And they didn't. They've only managed to refill 4.8 million barrels. And they've come out and said, oh, we'll buy the oil when it's, you know, 79. Or, I don't think they're going to get there.
Amrita Sen, thank you so much. And on behalf of John Farrell and Lisa, Team Surveillance really looks forward to interviewing you in Vienna here at the next Cranny Soiree.
Inflation, market volatility, economic insecurity. Who isn't looking for greater retirement security these days? As one of America's largest financial services companies, Nationwide helps millions of people invest in their financial futures. With client-friendly resources and innovative solutions, Nationwide supports financial professionals so they can help clients feel more confident in their retirement years. Nationwide is on your side. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It offers flexible spending capacity that adapts to your business. You can also earn up to $395 in annual statement credits on eligible purchases at select business merchants. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Right now we're going to begin here, Manus Cranny, Lisa Bramitz, and Tom Keene, with our definitive call of the day on global fixed income. Wei Li is Global Chief Investment Strategist at BlackRock, prodigious in mathematics, and joins us here on our fears of price down and yield up. Whaley, thank you so much for finding the time. Where is the bid on bonds? To me, the bid is walked away. Is that true? Is there just a dearth of bid across all of fixed income?
There are lots of moving parts right now. Good morning, everyone. In terms of our view on long bonds, long duration, we have been underweight U.S. long duration for 3 years now, since late 2020, when 10-year yields was below 1%. And last week, we closed the underweight to get to neutral. There are a couple of moving parts in terms of why rates have repriced so very meaningfully. The first piece is policy path repricing. And the second piece is term premium repricing. And within that, inflation premium is part of term premium. So where we are now with 10-year yields testing 5%, in our assessment, policy path is not that different from where we think it should be. But term premium, depending on which measure you use, we're looking at somewhere between 20 basis point, 40 basis point, different methodology, actually could push even higher over the strategic horizon. So we're talking about term premium over the strategic horizon at 100 basis point, not out of this world because of fiscal imbalance, because of issuance dynamics, because of higher rate environment, rate volatility, as well as because of higher inflationary environment. So when you bring all of that together, strategically we're still underweight, but tactically we're now neutral because risks have now become more balanced. And when we think about kind of the read across of rate repricing to risk assets, actually policy path repricing can be negative for equities because it impacts the discount rates directly. But term premium repricing doesn't have to be negative for equities because it's more an assessment of the relative appeal of duration in portfolios.
Do you think, Wei, I know that you've been leaning into the whole AI discussion and the whole AI thesis, and that's been driving some of your equity bets. Do you think that that area is completely immune to term premia and these discussions of yields, given the cash cows that they've become?
Well, what has been very interesting with regards to this mega tech and AI theme is that on the one hand, they benefit from the growth upgrades, earnings upgrades that we're seeing coming through. So, for example, next year, 10% EPS forecast for S&P 500. Half of that is driven by mega tech names, right? 5% is coming from the tech names. So they're definitely benefiting from earnings upgrades, which we pay a lot of attention to. But at the same time, they are more long duration compared with the broader equity market. So when rate reprices, it pressures down on long duration a little bit more, everything else being equal. But when you bring the two factors together, actually the growth prospect and the AI theme gathering momentum and the earnings upgrades actually trump the duration sensitivity, as we have seen so far earlier in the year, but also in recent periods of rate repricing. Actually, the AI theme, the Nasdaq, have been holding up better than you would have expected given the rate volatility.
Wei, good morning. Just to carry on from that, this week they're going to see $16 trillion worth of equity reports, and the magnificent part of the Magnificent Seven of tech are going to be in there. What Tom, Lisa, and myself, what we're talking about was the balance sheets, the cash on the balance sheets, the cash on Apple's balance sheet, the cash on the other big tech. Is that another defensive hallmark and a reason to endure and stay long big tech?
That is why we are still overweight the big tech and AI theme, because when we think about kind of quality characteristics as growth slows down, reacts to the tightening environment that we're all experiencing, actually having cash on your balance sheet and not being as geared up in this environment is a definite plus. And more broadly, we're talking about kind of the impression of the earnings season, that the feeling is that it's holding up better, but actually not forget the broader backdrop, which is the earnings. Mm-hmm. Actually, the three quarters have been stagnating. And we're just talking about incremental rebound from the stagnating backdrop. So that's the big picture here.
Whaley, Lawrence from New York emails in and says, ask Whaley, if an institutional firm marks to market and everything else is on the balance sheet and the rationalization is I can own it forever and I'll get paid back eventually, baloney. How do you do the math on the midpoint of where the stuff you hold on the balance sheet gets a valuation. If I've got 8 years of maturity, how close is it to where you get a tipping point where you've got to confront what's on the balance sheet?
Well, first, say hello to Lawrence. And second, yes, indeed, we have to see more repricing of risk assets reflecting the higher rate environment. We look at duration, we're kind of almost there, which is why tactically we turned neutral. But if you look at equities, it has yet to reflect the higher rate environment by our very simple kind of arithmetic, kind of very simple back of the envelope analysis. You know, like further 5% to 10% adjustment is not, you know, unthinkable. And then you think about private markets, there is also further repricing to go, which is why greater dispersion, greater selectivity is really warranted as we think about kind of deploying your risk budget in this environment, because there is a different rate sensitivity across risk spectrum, which is why we're very selective when it comes to equities. Right. We're focusing on sectors that are growing earnings, but also very selective in terms of the private market. We like private credit. We like infrastructure debt, all these parts of private markets that are benefiting from secular tailwinds.
I don't hear full faith in credit there. Wei Li, thank you so much of BlackRock. Subscribe to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Listen live every weekday starting at 7 a.m. Eastern on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can watch us live on Bloomberg Television and always on the Bloomberg Terminal. Thanks for listening. I'm Tom Keene, and this is Bloomberg.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It offers flexible spending capacity that adapts to your business. You can also earn up to $395 in annual statement credits on eligible purchases at select business merchants. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. Two 420-foot vertical speedways, three launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 Gs in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.